A Confirmation Sunday Sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on May 4, 2003, entitled Living with Intentionality. The texts for the sermon are Psalm 16, verses 7 through 11, and Luke 12, verses 41 through 48. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Once again this year we have a wonderful crop of young people, and why shouldn't they be wonderful? They're yours. And when I think about this service, I begin my thinking in terms of them and what I might want to say to them, but try as well to find something that is not simply a word for them, but really a word for us all, and I hope that'll be the case this morning. For as I was thinking about this whole matter some weeks ago, I think we were in the midst of either building up for the war, probably the war had begun, and there were images in my mind of devastation, death, destruction, and pictures of liberation of those who were tearing down huge statues of a despot and experiencing for the first time what it meant to breathe without fear and trembling. And as I thought about that whole situation, and I thought about young people, these young people of ours growing up in this community, this broader community, this faith community, and families like you represent, the phrase came to me, they are the lucky ones. Or I could say, in this service, we are the lucky ones. As we contemplate the whole global situation, we indeed are the lucky ones. And I always use the word luck, as I've confessed here before, with a bad conscience, because my father would never let me say that something was a matter of luck, because there was this matter of divine providence. And I must admit that in his life, a life which I deeply respect, that sense of divine providence, that sense that all was the will of God, issued in an authentic humility. So when I say to our young people, when I say to all of us, we are the lucky ones, I am acknowledging that I'm using a non-church, non-sanctuary, non-theological, non-sermonic word. But I'm going to say it anyway. You are the lucky ones. And I was lucky enough to find that in Psalm 16, the lottery is not a modern invention about which we argue with Native Americans. With casinos and slot machines and all that kind of thing. For the fifth verse of the 16th Psalm speaks about the Lord being my chosen portion and my cup, you hold my lot. Now that's not lot as a lot on Lake Michigan, but it's a lot in terms of the rolling of the dice and the consequence thereof. He goes on in the sixth verse to say, the boundary lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. I have a goodly heritage. And the background of verses 5 and 6 of Psalm 16 is the land distribution when the Israelites invaded Palestine, the land of the Canaanites, conquered the land in an early instance of ethnic cleansing, by the way. And they got into the land, and the various tribes were given portions of the land. And at one point, if you go back and read through the book of Joshua, which I don't recommend, it's not particularly edifying, but you would find there that at a certain point, Joshua got upset with the fact that they weren't getting the job done, and so he gathered them together before the tabernacle at Shiloh, and he rolled the dice. They had a lottery. And the portion of land that you got was the consequence of how the lots were cast. And so you see, the lottery is not a modern invention. Now, there was a certain advantage in that, and actually ancient agrarian societies often used that method by which to distribute the pasture land in a community. What that did was create a kind of equality in the community. It ruled out the possibility of some aggressive entrepreneur taking the whole thing over and doing a little empire building and crowding everybody out. And ever so often, there was a redistribution of the land, and there was, again, a lottery. And so, it was the throw of the dice. It was whether or not you were fortunate or lucky in the land that was given to you to care for. There wasn't such a thing as owning a piece of property, so to speak, because in the biblical idea, the earth is the Lord's, and we're just stewards, and we get a portion of it to maintain and by which to maintain ourselves. But the ownership belongs to God. We could use that today, couldn't we? And so, with the casting of the sacred lot. Now, it was done at the tabernacle. It was done in the context of prayer. And so they believed that the outcome was reflective of the will of God. I think today we might suspect that that has an element of superstition about it. It's not really altogether different between praying and then going to find out what God's will is for my life. And there are people who still do that too. But my point is that there was an element of luck or good fortune, even when it was bathed in prayer. There's a verse in Proverbs, which one preacher I heard one day translated as, "Man rolls the dice, but God makes the spots turn up." You know, come on, lucky seven or something like that. And so if you do go to Las Vegas and you pull the slots, I would suggest you pray first. Well, I'm being a little bit facetious, but only a little bit facetious, because I want to say to the young people today, and I want to say to all of us, we are the lucky ones. And when I say that, I want to say to us that we ought to avoid what is a temptation of godly people, which, when good fortune comes, are very thankful to God, but also secretly suspect that they may be special. And if you're in tight religious communities very long, you will pick up here and there the subtle suggestion that one's good fortune is the consequence of some special favor of God. And it's meant so sincerely, it's meant as an expression of humility, and yet the other side of it is, if my good fortune is the consequence of God's special ordering, what about those who aren't so fortunate? Is that also the consequence of God's ordering? And then can I help from sensing a bit of spiritual pride? And the other aspect of tight religious communities, which is most insufferable, is that self-righteousness that comes along with it. Have you ever run into it? So, you see, I may sound impious, I may sound reckless when I say you're the lucky ones, but I also may be sparing you from the idea that you're special and that somehow or other your specialness is the consequence of a special righteousness. And so I think it's not altogether unhealthy or unbiblical, really. I confess the psalmist or Joshua and that old ancient Israelite rite, I know there was a sincere and deep belief that God was ordering these things. But when you think through a little bit more deeply, then that kind of an ordering God who does so much to establish us has got a lot to answer for those who are disestablished. So that's really the first thing that I want to say to those young people, and I think it's a good word for all of us. We are the lucky ones. And rather than trying to figure it out, how God has worked all this out, maybe it would be wise just simply to accept it. Here we are. Are we not a fortunate people? Are we not hugely blessed? And that's why, without trying to figure it out, I keep saying year after year, all is grace, all is gift. And if all is grace and all is gift, or in my colloquial phrase, if we're so lucky, then really there should arise from us a deep gratitude and a deep humility. Who of us chose to be born? Who of us chose our parents? Who of us chose to be born where we were born and when we were born? And if we really take that seriously, then we recognize what the cosmologists tell us is true of the whole cosmos, of the whole universe, and that is that randomness is the rule. Those who study these things tell us that that what has emerged in the universe and what has emerged in our human history and our human story is a matter of random occurrences all along the line. There could have been trajectories in a thousand or a million different ways. As a matter of fact, what has transpired has brought us to where we are. And maybe it is the simplest thing, just to say, we're the lucky ones. And then to thank God for that, but to recognize that it's not a God who's playing dominoes with people or chess with people, but that it's a whole huge universal process that has brought us through randomness throughout to this present moment where we have to shake our heads and say, dear God, we're the lucky ones. The lot has fallen to me. The boundary lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. I have a goodly heritage. If that's so, then what will we do about it? How do we respond to it? And so I read the story of Jesus. The occasion is a question about a family that's disputing over an inheritance. Those things have broken up more families than this world knows of. All the disputes about who's going to get the china or the yadro or whatever. And Jesus said, look, don't bother me with that. That is so inconsequential. You know what life is about? Let me tell you a story about this farmer who prospered greatly. Jesus doesn't say anything derogatory about the person in terms of how he farmed or in terms of how he treated his help or how he was in his family. None of that's an issue here. It's just simply that we have a farmer who, of course, incidentally, is prospering because of sun, soil, and rain, which he didn't have a lot to do with. Nonetheless, says, I have a problem. I'm doing so well, I don't know what to do with my stuff anymore. Oh, I have it. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And Jesus said, you know what? That wasn't so smart. Because while he was talking to himself and planning for himself and congratulating himself, he was on the threshold of a coronary. And Jesus implies he really missed life because he was so concentrated on his prosperity and the building of his empire that he failed to really live and to really enter into life in true engagement. And so, if we're the lucky ones, my question is, what are we doing about it? It seems to me that that's a good question for us as a nation. I've mentioned before our national leadership is determined to establish the Pax Americana, the American peace, and believes that this is the American century and that we need to increase our military spending, that we need to increase our military spending $15 to $20 billion a year annually. We who have just demonstrated to the world our incomprehensible might and power need to sit down now and figure out how to increase our military power and prowess in order that we might maintain our preeminence, while education budgets get cut, and old people like me about to retire don't have prescription drug help, and there are potholes in the roads, and the infrastructure of the wealthiest nation in the world needs a lot of help. Sounds to me like building bigger barns. I don't know, I'm just a simple person, but that's what it sounds like. You're on top of your game, so you expend your energy and your resources to see if you can top the top. And, of course, when I think about that and I think about how helpless I feel in the light of that, like placing your body in the path of a tank, then I could get despairing, but then I have to come down and say, but what can I do? Finally, I can't change the whole world, but is there anything that we can do? And I want to hold before the young people the example of one of the truly great human beings, Albert Schweitzer. Do you know that Schweitzer was one of the most prominent, gifted, brilliant biblical scholars and theologians of his day while in his 20s? Do you know that he became a world-renowned organist, student of Vidor, one of the greatest Bach scholars in the world? And then, of course, after accomplishing the peak in both of those fields, he began to study medicine and became the missionary doctor in Africa in his hospital at Lamborghini. But he was 21 years old when he wrote, this is his autobiography, "Long ago in my student days, I had thought about it. It struck me as inconceivable that I should be allowed to lead such a happy life while I saw so many people around me struggling with sorrow and suffering. Even at school, I had felt stirred whenever I caught a glimpse of the miserable home surroundings of some of my classmates and compared them with the ideal conditions in which we children of the parsonage at Ginsbach had lived. At the university, enjoying the good fortune of studying and even getting some results in scholarship and the arts, I could not help but think continually of others who were denied that good fortune by their material circumstances or their health. One brilliant summer morning at Ginsbach, during the Whitsuntide holidays, it was in 1896, he was 21, As I awoke, the thought came to me that I must not accept this good fortune as a matter of course, but must give something in return. While outside the birds sang, I reflected on this thought, and before I had gotten up, I came to the conclusion that until I was 30, I could consider myself justified in devoting myself to scholarship and the arts. But after that, I would devote myself directly to serving humanity. I had already tried many times to find the meaning that lay hidden in the saying of Jesus, "Whoever would save his life shall lose it, and whoever shall lose his life for my sake in the Gospels shall save it." Now I had found the answer. I could now add outward to inward happiness. And he did it. His parents, his family, his teachers, his university associates, his colleagues in the arts, they all tried to talk him out of it. They all said, "What a waste, how foolish." But he was undeterred, and he did it. And after achieving fame and prestige through significant engagement in theology, music, he became a jungle doctor and has impacted the world through a life that has received every acclamation and award possible. He got his clue from Jesus. His book, The Quest of the Historical Jesus, is still a classic. He was fascinated with Jesus, and he found a way to live it out. We're going to come to this table now, and we're going to take bread that's broken and a cup that's poured out, which is the price of caring ultimately. But when we take the bread and the cup, it's not to get our sins forgiven and to get into heaven after being the lucky ones here, but it's to be a sign of solidarity with that one whose name we claim, whose way we follow, who asks of us everything, and in return promises us life.